Hey, what's happening?
Brother, what's up?
This is a good party, man.
Yeah, brother, like, it. Solid. Right on.
The Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. That's 844-967-2789. You can text us at that same number. Good morning to you, Connor. How you doing? You have enough dry turkey?
Did I have enough dry turkey, Earl?
Yeah.
I had so much turkey.
Yeah.
It was a great weekend.
Yeah.
Did you have a dry turkey? Or did you...
No, my turkey was not dry. That's the least... of the worries that the turkey was dry. I doctor him up a little bit.
Yeah, I gotta make sure I get mine from you next time.
I'll bring you some leftovers tomorrow. I thought about it today.
Oh, thank you.
But it's...
Right, your turkeys,
yes.
Don't you?
Yeah. Yes.
Which makes them not dry.
Well, what makes them not dry is the embalming fluid that I put in them.
I see.
Embalming fluid.
It's a mortuary, Vinny. It's not a kitchen.
So you actually, I use orange juice,
mm-hmm.
butter,
mm-hmm.
fresh basil,
mm.
different spices, and I doctor it up. I inject it throughout the entire bird. And you do that a night before, which gives it a chance. This is after brining the birds, right?
Yeah.
So for those who don't know, brining the bird makes the bird...
Soaking it in salt water.
Yeah, but no, I didn't use salt water.
Isn't brine salt water?
But there's a, you can buy a kit,
mm-hmm.
right, at Sam's Club that uses a bunch of different spices. And so you don't inject that. You actually just put that the bird in a bag with the brine. For 12 to 14 hours, and then you take it out, and then you inject it, and then you leave it in for, it's quite expensive.
And you did like five of these.
Five.
Yeah.
It takes time, and then when you fry it, it's...
When turkeys see you, they they run the other direction.
and then when you fry it, it's 4 minutes per pound.
In the deep fryer.
In the peanut oil, mm-hmm. correct.
And that's until the peanut oil catches fire?
No, because the...
Because I've seen some YouTubes of some pretty damn exciting turkey frying episodes.
Well, that was the primitive way of doing it.
Uh-huh.
Right?
Yeah.
I mean, they came up with an electric fryer where you do it inside.
Oh, so you don't have to risk...
Yeah.
You don't have to risk going to the hospital, the burn unit.
And why that would happen, Sandy, is when you would do it outside...
I saw they drop it in, and then the thing fizzes over because the water hits the oil in it.
No, that's because they put too much peanut oil in it, and they don't understand that once you put the weight in the turkey.
Mean the Archimedes principle?
I don't know who the Archimedes is.
Eureka. Archimedes is the guy that got in the bathtub. The bathtub overflowed.
Oh, yeah, same principle.
And he figured out that the weight displacement, mass displacement of the going in the fluid, raised the fluid, and he ran down the street naked shouting, Eureka. Wait,
let me get a...
That's the story, at least.
Let me get something so I can write that down.
The Archimedes principle.
That's exactly what it is. Once you put the bird in, all of that comes up.
Yep. These people never take baths? they haven't figured this out?
No. Well, and the other part of it is, when you're doing it outside during the winter months, the wind blows, which you can't regulate the temperature of the flame, which then increases, the peanut oil burns at 376.
It boils, you mean?
It burns.
Oh, it burns.
Yeah, it's such a light oil that once it gets to 376 degrees, it will ignite.
I see.
And you can't control the flame when you're outside because of the wind.
Okay.
So this electric one, it won't go past 375.
So did you ever do it pre-electric?
Yes.
And did you ever have a fire incident?
No, what I did was burned up a lot of turkeys because the wind, I couldn't control the temperature.
I see.
And then it would burn the birds. Mm-hmm. So I was so happy when the electric fryers came out. You had to stand over the birds when you're frying them outside. You can't move. You got to watch it at all times. But inside, the electricity won't allow it to go past the 375, so you get the optimum temperature.
Yeah.
Where it won't ever burn. And I can go and watch my football game.
Jacques Pepin cooks the bird. You should speak with a French accent.
That's probably one thing I'm not capable of doing. But I'll tell you, man, it's, you know, twice a year.
Twice. You do this at Christmas, too?
Yes, yeah, sometimes. Easter? No, just...
Those are rabbits?
When I do it for... When people ask me to do it, and that's twice a year.
Now that I know you'll do it upon request.
Yeah, man, let me know.
Yeah, no.
Yeah, let me know. And I'll tell you, they're succulent, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because what happens is once you drop the bird inside of the peanut oil that's boiling at 375, it seals all the pores of the bird, and so no juice can get out. So the bird actually cooks from the inside out. That juice that you that stuff is the stuff, and that's how it stays moist. And so you should be asking the question: why am I not in business selling
these turkeys?
Yeah.
Earl, why aren't you in business selling these turkeys? But it sounded like a cue to me, Connor. I don't know.
Because of the amount of work and labor that goes into them, people aren't willing to know and pay you for your time
right.
that you're putting into each one, right? If you really looked at the hours and the time...
Those turkeys should cost a lot of money.
They should. Yeah. And if you look and say, well... I want a deep fried turkey online, and you order it online, it's going to cost 2 to 3 times. You know, you can order them online, and they'll send them to your house already prepared.
Yeah,
yeah. But I certainly couldn't. I think I probably charged one person out of those 5 turkeys. So it's not something, it's a labor of love.
And now that people on the radio all know that one guy knows he was the onion in the petunia patch. Wait a minute.
It's a labor of love. But anyway.
So ask me if I cooked turkey.
Did you cook turkey?
No, I cooked lobsters and shellfish and things like that. Because I thought... My children all have other houses to go to for their turkey. So I thought I'd give them an option here. So I decided for the first time in my life, I decided to grill these shellfish, which kept me nervous for a bunch of days, but it turned out it was quite easy to do. But I understand from you, pre-show, that lobsters have become a very controversial food.
Yeah, people don't want you to be able to do that again. There's something wrong.
Well, mine were just lobster tails.
Yeah, but
now it's probably true they had to sacrifice the whole lobster to get me the tail.
What is it about people? And we talk about animal rights people, right? And I understand. You know, you and I talked about the poor deer.
Yeah.
Last week, and you look at the deer and you say, "Wow, that's a beautiful animal." And doesn't hurt anybody, doesn't...
Well, the fact that we are omnivores leads me to believe that there might be restriction on the kind of things, the numbers of animals we'll eat, but I suspect that animals are a sort of a necessary part of the human diet. Although, you know, you can't just live on plants, but our teeth and everything were designed to chew something more than just plants. We only have one stomach. We don't have a cud and, you know, the whole, the animals that ruminate, the ones that are just on grass, are made differently than we are.
Well, so how did... The Homo sapiens long before us, our teeth weren't shaped in a manner to tear meat. They didn't have utensils.
Oh, no.
I'm sure they didn't have
front,
knives.
Our front teeth are designed to tear and chew. You know, that's why we That's why we got the smile. That's why we've got such a beautiful smile, so you can bite some meat.
But raw meat is what they didn't cook it originally. They didn't know about cooking the meat.
Are you suggesting that I'm so old that I should know the answers to questions about prehistoric man?
No, man. I'm just, you know, you make me think, so... But anyway,
yeah.
So the people don't want lobsters, and Whole Food is now being pressured not to sell lobsters anymore. Your thoughts on that?
Wow, you know, in my triage of important things to think about,
that hasn't
surfaced, but now it has. I'll have to think about it. I guess the question is, are lobsters getting scarce? If lobsters are getting to be very scarce on this planet, and it could be that they're overfishing lobsters in the Northeast, where we catch in lobsters. But several years ago, lobsters were plentiful and quite cheap. So, gosh, I don't know.
But Sandy, with all the things to worry about.
Exactly.
In the world.
Yeah.
People have organized and marched on Whole Foods and said, hey, you stop selling those lobsters. Because, after all, they're animals.
Mosquitoes are important, too. But
and so what do you do with a fly, right?
Yeah.
You know,
flies. Well, all the elements of the ecosystem are pretty important. And so it is true that human beings there are several species that have come upon the scene who have had remarkable effects on the ecosystem. I think one of the early ones were the wolves. The wolves were remarkably good predators, and they changed the balance, the ecosystem balance, but it became balanced, and it became used to the process of wolves. I think the problem with the human impact on the ecosystem is that it doesn't reach equilibrium. Our appetite for things is unlimited, and our capacity to take them is much, much greater than any natural predator.
All right, we've got to go to a break. 844-967-2789 is the number. It's Monday. That means Mondays with my co-host, Sandy Williams. We'll be right back. To the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. It's 844-967-2789. You can text us at that same number. Listen, we got to talk a little bit about the Packers and the Badgers. And
worthy day, I'll tell you. Lots of sports news.
Well, yeah, you know, did you watch any of the soccer?
I did watch some soccer.
Well, football. They call it.
Yeah, football.
Yeah. Well, so, you know, they're not going to debate you on it. That's what they call it.
Well, when you get down to it, football makes a lot more sense for soccer than football makes for what we play.
Yeah,
which,
no question.
We probably put our foot on the ball in a game, I don't know what, 10 times on each side?
That's correct.
Max.
Field goals and punting.
Kickoffs.
And kickoffs. That's basically it.
Yep.
But anyway, what were your thoughts? You love soccer?
I do like soccer. And I went several years ago. I was lucky enough to get tickets. I went to a Liverpool-Everton game with my son. He happened to be in England, and I planned a trip to be there at the same time, and we went to see the soccer game. A premier soccer league in England is a big deal, and the games are big deals.
What, 100,000 people?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. Whatever the stadium holds, that's how many people are there. Nobody sits during the whole game, at least at this game. Everyone, there were songs and chants that went 100% of the time. It's like a group involvement thing. Now, the only problem with soccer in the Premier League, at least, is there's a lot of rowdies, I think they call them. And so this group involvement can involve potentially dangerous group involvement. There's more security than you can believe, and they separate fans. They're very meticulous about separating the fans from one another for fear that they'd have a breakout of inter-fan activity, they might call it, you know?
So let me ask you, because in America, in our sports games, football and basketball, they make adjustments to the sport to increase scoring, because they think the excitement comes from actually scoring.
Yeah.
Soccer.
Obviously not the case, because a huge game would be 6-1. You know, that would be a huge gap. And, soccer is it's about the beauty of the game. It's, you know, it's a much more sophisticated audience. We should realize that soccer is different than any sport we have, in that in the rest of the world, everybody plays soccer. You know, when you grow up and you go to the playground and you play a game, you play soccer. When you have sandlot games and you go out to the field to play with your friends, you play soccer. And so it's a game that everyone has participated in. Everyone understands the nuances of it and the skill level of these professional. Well, we can see it if you watch these. The skill level of these people, what they do with the ball with their feet, it's incredible. They pass the ball as accurately with their feet as I don't know who. Not Aaron Rodgers, although maybe now Aaron Rodgers.
You know, Sandy, it kind of reminds me, with the ability that they have with their feet, the guys who play hockey with the hockey stick.
Yeah.
I mean, to see what guys can do with that stick and with that puck is just an amazing kind of thing. And you know it takes high skill levels in order to be on those skates spinning around, and then to see the whole rink and to see a guy over in the corner while there's a guy pestering you trying to get the puck from you.
Yeah, I've got. I mean, I watched 22 years of youth hockey with my sons, and I'm back at it with my grandchildren. And I foolishly got into an adult hockey game once and found out how hard it was, much harder than walking and chewing gum.
Yeah.
To play hockey, it requires all kinds of skills that are unbelievable.
But so anyway, Packers are now 4-8, and
Aaron Rodgers might be in the rearview mirror.
They're at the point now where he's probably not going to play next week. Jordan Love came in, that guy.
Apparently, you know, I told you I didn't watch the game, but I did read the GameCast about it and watch the GameCast to spare myself the problem. And you know, we scored 33 points, for gosh sake. You know, if we had a defense that was sound, they had 356 yards rushing or something.
Well, here's the deal. Before the season started, they spent all this money
on the defense.
And they were saying the Packers are going to have the best defense in football. And things don't always go according to plan.
Well, right? Rashawn Gary going down was a big thing.
Yeah, but
he's only one guy.
Right.
No, there's no question. And the Packers, for some reason, and maybe pro football generally, but the Packers particularly, for the last 5-6 years, regardless of who the defensive coordinator is, they can't seem to stop the run.
Well, and the other part of this, Sandy, is they put all this money in their safeties and defensive backs. And maybe, you know, they've not been able to find that defensive guy or the defensive ends that they need.
I think it's a combination of pass rush, lack of pass rush, which puts more pressure on the D-backs. I mean, a D-back probably has 3.5 seconds of coverage that you can be assured of.
Right.
If it goes beyond 3.5 seconds, probably Katie bar the door in terms of being able to stop a passer if he's in a position to pass in a lane and feel secure about the passing, you know.
So speaking of passing, we're going to move past sports, even though we got to talk a little bit about the Badgers.
We didn't talk about the Badgers.
Yeah, and so but we have to do fickle, it after the break.
How fickle of you!
Yeah. Right, I got it.
Yeah.
It took me a while to catch it, but you know, Fickell being the new coach that's going to be coming, pretty shrewd guy, man. 844-967-2789. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. 844-967-2789. You can text us at that same number. We got to get a little more football and sports out of the way because, you know, I watched the game between Michigan and Ohio State on Saturday, and it was an unbelievable football game. And anytime Michigan and Ohio State, they were both 11-0, right? Number two and number three ranked.
Yeah. Yep.
And so when you have two 11-0 teams, Ohio State was the favorite, and it didn't turn out that way. Michigan just had four spectacular plays that really made the difference, and they were all big plays. Couple long runs of 60 yards and more, and a couple long passes. And, you know, that's not the way the old Woody Hayes and Bo Schembechler Michigan-Ohio State games used to be played. It was, you know.
That was 3 yards in a cloud of dust. That was what I think Woody Hayes might have started that expression, in fact. I'm not sure, but that was surely the way Ohio State always played.
Yeah, and so just to watch the game, you know, I got a chance to sit. I can't believe just the last 4 or 5 days I had off, I felt guilty, man. I mean, I just sat around and did nothing.
Well, it sounds like you watch TV.
Yeah, well, sports.
Yeah.
You know, and watched the Buck games and was just felt like, man, I didn't get anything done or accomplished. But, you know.
So the Badgers.
Yeah.
Yeah, they went out of the Badger sandbox. I mean, Crist was an old Badger, grew up in Madison. Played for the Badgers, coached the Badgers. I think Alvarez was the last time they went out. Well, Bielema too, but both of those guys didn't have any Badger blood. But Leonard certainly was deep in Badger blood. You know, from Wisconsin, walk on at Wisconsin, played. You know, had an illustrious pro career. I was surprised. And maybe it's good, though. I mean, I think Wisconsin is basically with this action. They're announcing, hey, we're a national football team, and we're going to attack this nationally. We're going to recruit nationally, and we're going to try and be up there. Next time there's the game on TV, we want it to be Wisconsin, Ohio State, or whomever.
Well, right? They're turning the page. And I can tell you that before the game, they did an excerpt on what's the guy's name that coached? Interim coach, you just for the Badgers.
The interim, Bill Bielema?
No, the guy that they just
Fickell.
No, that's the new guy.
Oh, Jim Leonard.
Jim Leonard, and they were saying he never went to the big office. Okay, he stayed in the assistant coach's office, even though he became the head coach. He never went to the big office, and so they did this excerpt on it.
I think he's a hell of a guy, and I suspect he's got a big future in football. You know, there's already speculation that he's going to jump to become defensive coordinator of the Green Bay Packers, and it looks like they couldn't go wrong in that direction. I mean, the current defensive coordinator hasn't delivered on the promise that the that they had for the defense at the beginning of the year, that's for sure.
You know, Sandy, let's turn the page.
Yeah.
You drink a lot of water, right?
I got to confess, my name is Sandy Williams, and I drink a lot of water.
So, you know, there have been scientific research that says you should drink how much water a day?
Well, it's something like
64 ounces.
Well, no, it has to do with your weight, and I think it's half your weight in ounces of water. So if you
weigh a day.
So if you weigh 170, you drink 85 ounces of water. That's what I've read. But I did see that. I did see that Bruce. Are you getting to the Bruce Lee death thing, that he died from drinking too much water?
No, I'm not getting. I'm getting to this story.
Okay, well, that is a story that was this weekend as well.
Really?
Yeah.
So this story is about, I always knew guzzling 2 liters of water a day was over the top. Now science is on my side. That all of this water that we've been drinking, scientists now say, has not been necessary. I don't know how you make the determination, Sandy, on what science is telling the truth, right?
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I mean, science is, you know, of course, one of the problems with today's day and age is we've apparently put all science into the suspect category and allowed everyone to believe what they want to believe. There's certainly the capacity for human beings to be dehydrated. The doctor tells you what color your pee should be, right. You know, and so, you know, I think there's something to it. You need to drink enough water. There's no question about it. And I think it's a lot more water than some people have a proclivity to drink. Absent that, I know that there's a tendency of people as they get older to drink less and to be more dehydrated. So, you know, who knows? But I got to believe that there's an appropriate amount of water to drink. But there was news this weekend that in the analysis of what might have caused Bruce Lee's death, which was always been a source of controversy, what killed this martial artist so early in his life? And now they're thinking that it might have been actually drinking too much water. So sometimes people call that drowning.
Well,
but they didn't call it drowning. They said that basically you can drink so much water that your kidneys can't deal with it and they break down.
You know, I just have been trying to drink 64 ounces or more of water a day. I really do try.
I do drink 84 a day, basically.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, well.
Excuse me. I've got it. No.
Listen, man. I can't do it because I'm running back and forth. My bladder won't hold it. Right.
Yeah.
Well,
this is we're getting into.
Yeah, I know that.
We're getting into TMI here little bit. Yeah.
But anyway. Just, you know, maybe once science continues to evolve, and maybe back when those scientists did their research, that was the way it was. Maybe now the scientists now have taken it a further step, and maybe there'll be a time and there'll be somebody who'll take it even a step further. Science is not absolutely 100% correct on things, right?
Well, what's interesting is one of the things we know less about than we should is the human body at large. You know, we seem to know a lot about things exogenous outside of us, but, you know, we don't know much about how our brain works, and we keep finding out different things about how our bodies work, and we certainly don't know much about our microbiome, you know, how we digest food and what all that's about. So I do think the world in the future is going to involve lots of discoveries, because there's far more research going into things like the bacteria in our gut, and people, they're realizing how very important it is, and so who knows? Something as fundamental as water and how much we drink probably is yet to be discovered.
You know, Sandy, I'm looking for something that an article that will take us to where I wanted this thing to go in the first place, and that's the fact that artificial intelligence, China, and what's the guy's name? He's 99 years old. He's Wow, I can't. I got it here somewhere.
You think it's Secretary of State Henry Kissinger? He's the only.
Yeah. How did you know?
Well, he's 99.
Yeah.
Okay, let's put it this way: there's a limited universe of 99-year-old people. Yeah.
Who can still function?
Yes.
And Henry Kissinger is talking about artificial intelligence, and he is saying that it is going to be one of the most. Americans and Chinese aren't understanding, and I got the article here somewhere, the inherent dangers of artificial intelligence. What are your thoughts?
Well, it is unbelievable what it might accomplish, and I do know that there was an experiment. Now, this I don't think it was apocryphal. I think this is a true reporting, that there was an experiment being done where they were teaching machines to learn languages, okay? And they had machines talking to one another with the languages that the programmers had provided to them, and the programmers thought that what would happen is that the artificial intelligence machines would develop more sophisticated ways of using the language they provided them. But lo and behold, what happened was the machines taught themselves new languages, and they began to communicate to one another in languages that the programmers didn't understand. And the programmers thought, oh, God.
That's one of those sci-fi.
Yeah. Ooh. And so apparently they quickly turned the machines off, like, uh-oh.
So
we don't know what they're talking about.
So artificial intelligence, Sandy, is it? Henry Kissinger spent much of his career thinking about dangers of nuclear weapons, but at 99, a former Secretary of State says he has become obsessed with a very modern concern, how to limit the potential destructive capabilities of artificial intelligence, whose powers could be far more devastating than even the biggest bomb. Kissinger described artificial intelligence as the new frontier of arms control during a forum at Washington National Cathedral on November 16th. If leading powers don't find ways to limit artificial intelligence's reach, he said it is simply a mad race for some catastrophe. Connor, you and I were talking about artificial intelligence on, I think, Thursday. Remember you and I had a conversation?
Yeah, I think it was it was Tuesday.
Yeah, okay, yeah. Tuesday. So your thoughts on artificial intelligence. So yeah, and you had something you said something that I think Sandy should hear from a young man who's, involved in all that stuff.
Yeah, I mean, I think the point that we had made on Tuesday was that it was just, kind of the larger point about technology is a consequence of how you use it. It's a tool, harping on that and social media. But yeah, with artificial intelligence, I mean, I'm just going to repeat the same point. It's like people need to have a much more general understanding. The issue isn't necessarily with the technology, but more about the consolidation of power with that technology by governments, by use of government or larger corporations, right? And as a way to be able to use their AI systems to, censor or to limit certain people using whatever platform that is ubiquitous, right? In using it. That's the
Yeah, absolutely. And, I think it was called Firefly. One of the early uses of artificial intelligence was the manipulation of megadata to allow people like Amazon and others to evaluate on a gross, wide basis what it is that you and I seem to prefer. So they would be able to look at our habits, like Google can look at our habits on our phone, see the things that we, advertisements we look at, the things we Google and try to check out. And that provides a profile of us that begins to suggest the things we might like. So it became true for all of us that you'd open your phone and start looking at things and suddenly you would see ads for things that were the very thing that you had been looking at, right? You were looking for a car, and suddenly you're seeing ads for the kind of cars you were looking for. It's not a coincidence. And a lot of what Firefly was able to do was useful. you know, it brought to you information you were actually looking for, and so it was a win-win proposition. The people who had ads that they wanted to provide, to put in front of people who were interested in what they were advertising, was better accomplished, and the person who received the ad was actually, in some respects, pleased to get it. But that same sort of information can be used for much more nefarious purposes, and so then the question is, how do you control that? And now you get into the questions that relate to the restraint on government. Okay, government could get all this data and be able to use it, and they could use it nefariously, and there's very few restraints on that.
So
let's say the government
Sandy.
All right.
When we come back, we'll continue the conversation. It's Monday. That means Mondays with Sandy Williams. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. That's 844-967-2789. You can text us at that same number. It's Monday. That means Mondays with my co-host, Sandy Williams. So, Sandy, the last paragraph from former Secretary Kissinger. The warning from Kissinger, one of the world's most prominent statesmen and strategists, is a sign of the growing global concern about the power of thinking machines as they interact with global business, finance, and warfare. He spoke by video connection at a cathedral forum titled Man, Machine, and God, which was this year's topic in the annual Nancy and Paul Ignatius program named in honor of my parents. Now, Kissinger's concerns about artificial intelligence were echoed by two other panelists, Eric Schmidt, former chief of executive of Google and chairman of the congressionally appointed National Security Commission on Artificial Intelligence, which issued the report last year, and Annie Neuberger, the Biden administration's deputy national security advisor for cyber and emerging technology. So, Sandy, walk us through where the concerns are.
I was trying to explain. I think there are, like, this is an onion. You're unpeeling the onion. There's layers of concern here. One layer of concern is private industry being able to obtain all this megadata, and how do they use it, and do they use it for reasons that might be subject, that should be subject to restraint? So then the question is, who's going to restrain them? Well, it's going to be the government that would have to intervene and constrain them. So you end up with government controls over corporations and their ability to use the data about you. But then how does the government regulate it? Does the government require access to all that data in order to regulate it? If they do, the government's suddenly going to have access in a public sort of a way to stuff that was otherwise being privately gathered about you. Most of what's gathered about us is done on a semi-voluntary basis. We knew that the phone company knew about all of our phone calls, but then when the government NASA used the capacity to reach out and sweep from all the phone companies all of the phone calls that were made by everybody, you know, the Snowden disclosures, we end up finding out that, gosh, that could be used for nefarious purposes. Maybe it was only being used to find the guy who put the bomb in the next big building, but if it was there and available to be used otherwise, too, which became upsetting. So we've got the problem of private enterprise gathering all this data and the need of government to regulate that process. And then we've got the capacity of government as well to sweep up all that data and to use it. So now you have civil liberties at issue here, civil liberties with respect to the corporations that will get regulated by the government, and civil liberties with respect to each of us as citizens vis-a-vis the those companies and the government. And the gathering of megadata, which is the, in turn possibly used for our automated intelligence, becomes a very serious concern from a, the standpoint of sort of the political balance and political regulation. And I think that's how we end up with a confluence between the kind of government we have and the kind of government China has, because you end up with our government being asked to regulate all kinds of activities that are quite pertinent to the kind of controls that we point at China and say, look at what they're implementing, but by the same token, we're going to probably have to implement all kinds of controls ourselves just to deal with this new cyber capacity. And then we have the cyber capacity automated intelligence to take over things like our military defense, our military decision making. And it's already happening, I'm sure. I'm sure that out there in the field, they are using the ability to gather data from all parts of the military activities that are ongoing, put them into a pot, use that megadata to then be massaged by artificial intelligence to figure out what the next moves ought to be from a military standpoint and the military options, given the, all the options that are fed into this machine that makes these decisions. And I think Kissinger's pointing at all these problems and saying, these are all the ways that what is America could be affected by automated intelligence. There's no question that this capacity, number one, is going to happen. It is going to improve. It's the march of progress. But progress has its costs, and one of the costs is going to be the fact that we are all moving from our big city anonymity back to very small towns where everybody knows everything that's going on. And how comfortable are we going to be living as human beings in such a small town that everybody, including our government, knows everything that's going on?
But the United States is being pushed because China is so far advanced with artificial intelligence that we are now being pushed to, and forced to catch up, right?
Well, yes, and we, but we will. Artificial intelligence, like I said, I call automated artificial intelligence, right, is going to be a subject of great focus, because when you have all this data and this capacity to deal with it, you need computers and mega computers to deal with it, and it's just a question of programming the computers and figuring out then how to develop the artificial intelligence to understand that data better than a human could do it without the aid of the automation and the cyber capacity that artificial intelligence has. So it's going to happen. And, you know, it's as much an inevitable as the automobile was from the buggy.
Just the thought, the sheer thought that these machines can somehow outreason people is, I guess, where the real fear is, because they can't feel. I don't care what you do with artificial intelligence, it'll never be able to feel and understand the capacity of what it would be like to wipe out human beings.
Right. Ethics and morality are very hard to program, and you know, you can, they definitely are trying to do it. You try to put constraints on these decisions, but ultimately there's an intuitive aspect to ethics and morality where the human being just has a sense of the natural law of what's right and what's wrong that's very hard to program into a machine. And you can see that problem arise when you go to something like the War College. At War Colleges, where I'm sure they're using automated artificial intelligence more and more, you make assumptions about what the other side is going to do, and then you have to trump that. It's a chess game where the game you're playing has terrible consequences, and yet we teach ourselves to play that game. We get into war, we play that game. We're watching it unfold right now in Ukraine.
Sandy, you said War College. I know that
we haven't.
I know we don't even give it. But I know we have war colleges.
Absolutely. We've got both our military and our non-military people involved with military going to formal training, which is called war college.
All right, listen, got to go to a break. 844-967-2789. It's Mondays with Sandy Williams. We'll be right back. Gonna get it out.